Okay, so now we're into the 1840s and 1850s, but a little bit in the 1830s as well, with an alternative theory to the radical theory, which was called sometimes the substitution theory, because that's the kind of reactions on which it was based, or the type theory, or the unitary theory, to contrast with dualistic theory, the plus-minus thing. Remember what the trouble was? When substitution reactions were discovered that you could chlorinate hydrocarbons, what was the difficulty with radical theory with respect to that? Do you remember? Yeah, Mike? Pardon me? Why did it contradict dualism? Aviva? Right, you had to have the oil of bitter almonds, benzoyl hydride, both had to be plus if both were going to react with chlorine. So this was a problem, but there was another, perhaps even more serious problem that involved these substitution reactions, which Dumas found out when he studied the photochlorination of acetic acid. Why photo? Why do you say photochlorination, Henry? Why do you need light? Right, you had to get free radical, remember, we now know, to begin with. So you had to split chlorine, and you could do that with light. Once you had that, then you could get this chain reaction and didn't have to split any more intact molecules directly. Okay, but anyhow, he could do it with acetic acid as well. So here's acetic acid, acetyl hydroxide, reacting with chlorine, and it gave the chloroacetyl radical, and he could do it again and get dichloroacetic acid, or again and get trichloroacetic acid. Now, do you see what the problem with this is for dualism? Dualism, what's the idea of the radical theory? One idea is dualism, that plus holds on to minus, but what else? Yeah, Derek? That there's a group of atoms that acts as an element and proceeds all the way through a whole series of reactions, as benzoyl did, right? But here's a case where the element, acetyl, the organic element, this radical, is being changed into other radicals, right? There are changes happening within the radical. The hydrogen is being replaced successively by chlorine. So it's like transmutation of an element. Right, so this didn't look so good for the radical theory. So hydrogen could be substituted by equivalent amounts of halogen or oxygen or other elements. And these products, though, were all similar to one another. They were all acidic. Right, so you could change, you could keep the nature of the compound while transmuting the, quote, element, the radical. Right, so this didn't look much like radical theory. Okay, so it didn't change. These changes did not change the type of the molecule. Right, the fact that it was an acid. So that's why it came to be called the type theory, because there were certain types of molecules and you could do changes within them but keep the same type of molecule. And four types had been recognized by the time we got to about 1850 or 1853. One of these archetypal sort of Platonic types was water, another was hydrogen, another was hydrochloric acid, and a fourth was ammonia. Okay, so the notation of type theory was this. The central atom, if there was one, I mean, I say central, which seems to imply a geometry, but I don't mean that. So an element like nitrogen or oxygen would be written on the left, and then there'd be this bracket of things that could be in there, but could be substituted one for another. For example, consider ammonia on the right. You could change a hydrogen with an ethyl radical and make ethylamine or diethylamine or triethylamine, right? But all these were bases. Why do we say now they're all bases? Why would we say they're bases?
Because the high level of the nitrogen uncarried.
Right. Right, the unshared pair of nitrogen is a high HOMO in all cases. But they, of course, only did things like smell and taste and so on. For, to them, they were all bases, and they react with acids to give salts. So it preserved the type of the molecule even while you were changing what the Germans would have said was a radical, or what Dumas would have said a few years earlier. Okay, or in the case of water, you could change hydrogen for ethyl and get ethyl alcohol. Or in the case of hydrochloric acid, you could change the hydrogen for ethyl, and you could change the chlorine for iodine. And now you could react these two things together and exchange groups between them. So the ethyl could go on to the oxygen, and you'd get diethyl ether, and then you'd have potassium iodide. So this is a reaction that was discovered at that time. It was called the Williamson ether synthesis, because obviously it's a way to make ethers. But it was understood by these people in terms of this idea of the theory of types, okay, in which you could change one group or atom for another. Okay. So what did Dumas think about this in terms of the dualism had the idea that plus held on to minus. What's holding these things together within the types? He said molecules are like planetary systems, like the solar system, held together by a force resembling gravitation, but acting in accord with much more complicated laws. What are the laws, incidentally, we know now? It's Coulomb's potential energy, which of course he would have known about. But the crucial thing, remember, is the Schrödinger's kinetic energy. So much more complicated law. So in other words, he didn't know what held it together. Right? Didn't pretend to. Although the advocates of the dualistic radical theory said they knew what held it together. It was plus with minus. And Williamson, the guy who invented this ether synthesis, see, he was only 27 years old, said, formulae may be used as an actual image of what we rationally suppose to be the arrangement of constituent atoms in a compound. Notice that this is a completely different point of view from what Berzelius had. What was Berzelius expressing when he wrote a formula for a compound? What was he telling? Right, the composition. That is, what elements were there, and in what weight ratio. And if you follow Dalton, in what atomic ratio. Okay, but this is something completely different, to think that one of these things with the brackets might in some sense be an actual picture of what's in there, the arrangement of constituent atoms, as an orrery is an image of what we conclude to be the arrangement of our planetary system. You know what an orrery is? Yeah. You see them in a planetarium. They were popular in those days. Here's a picture of an orrery painted by Joseph Wright of Derby. And you know, these things had cranks on them, and the Earth would go around the Sun, and the Moon would spin around the Earth. You've seen these mechanical things. So the idea was that these formulas might, in some sense, be an actual picture, and that when you bring these two things together, they might sort of pivot and one group go over to another or something. This isn't real concrete, but the idea was that formulas might have something new to them, that they might actually show where things are, not just what's there and how much. Now, remember, butyl bromide with the space in it is a relic of radical dualism, but there's an alternative naming system that we still use, which came from the unitary theory, where we call the same compound bromobutane, right? So you have the type, which is like butane, but then you can do a substitution in it and put bromine in it. So it's all one thing instead of being two words. Okay, now, what would Berzelius have thought of this? He said, by reacting chlorine with ordinary ether, Dumas produced a very interesting compound, which he reckoned, according to the theory of substitutions, the French theory, to be an ether in which four atoms of chlorine replaced four atoms of hydrogen. What would Berzelius think about this, you think? If you were Berzelius, right, the leading chemist in the world, every year you write a review of all the work that's gone on in chemistry to point out what's important, what's not important. right? What people should always should remember and what's going to be the way to the future. So he's the big guru in organic chemistry or chemistry in general. So what does he think of this idea, you think, of the substitution theory? Does he think it's a promising new interpretation of chemistry? Well, here's what he said. An element as eminently electronegative, as chlorine would never be able to enter into an organic radical. This idea is contrary to the first principles of chemistry. That is, you can't trade hydrogen with chlorine. One's positive, one's negative. It just can't possibly work. There's got to be something wrong with this observation of Dumas. Okay. Incidentally, in this same paper, he wrote this thing, which as far as what it, the chemical content is not important. But the idea is, he said, R is a radical. And he writes R here as a radical. You know what the dot means to him? It means there's an oxygen on it. It doesn't mean what we mean. What do we mean when we write a dot on top of R? A single electron, a SOMO, right? But this was the first use, as far as I'm aware, of R to mean a general group. Okay. But at any rate, he says this can't possibly be, right? Dualism is the way things work. You can't possibly do a substitution like this. There was then conflict between the people in France who advocated type theory and the people in Northern Europe who advocated radical theory. The leading chemical journal at that time was this one, which says the Annals of Chemistry and Pharmacy, with the collaboration of Dumas in Paris, Graham in London, edited by Willer and Liebig. So it looks like all the leading guys from all countries are collaborating to produce this thing. In fact, the only person who really worked on it was Liebig. Okay, so this is in his sort of the other way around of Dumas writing the Dumas-Liebig paper. So this is from 1840, just this time when the controversy is getting underway. And in fact, the journal was called Liebig's Annalen later because it was his way of expressing himself to the wider world. Now, in this particular 1840, the first paper is by Dumas, actually. I mean, it's genuinely by Dumas, although it's written in German, as appropriate for this journal. It's on the law of substitution and the theory of types. So he says the general question he's asking in number one down here is, can one substitute the elements that play their role in any simple or compound substance equivalent for equivalent? So can you put chlorine in place of hydrogen, for example? And as you can imagine in this rather long paper, he concludes, yes, you can do this. But Liebig put this together with a number of other papers that had various points of view on the type theory. The next paper was this one, Remarks on the Previous Paper, and in fact it was by J.L., Justus Liebig, and he begins saying here, I'm a far cry from sharing the ideas that Monsieur Dumas has linked to the so-called laws of the substitution theory. And below it is another French paper on the substitution laws of Monsieur Dumas. And then a paper, or a letter more properly, from Paris, written the 1st of March 1840, on the law of substitution and the theory of types. And we'll get into this just in shortly a little bit, but notice that it has some really interesting formulas here, like Cl2Cl2 plus C4Cl6O3, and down at the bottom, Cl2Cl2Cl3Cl6Cl6 plus water, and so on. So we'll get... And that this one's written by a guy very little known called S.C.H. Vintler. So that if you read that whole word in German, it would be Schwindler, which means deceiver or swindler, right? So this is, you can guess who's behind this one, right? Who tells all the jokes? Wöhler. So Wöhler had sent this just as a joke to Berzelius, and then he sent a copy to Liebig, and Liebig, to Wöhler's consternation, published it, right? Which didn't amuse Dumas in the least. Okay, we'll show you what it was. But the next paper is by another Frenchman, Regnault, on the reactions of chlorine with the chlorides of ethanol, methanol, several points of the ether theory. So anyhow, this so-called letter to Justus Liebig, which was not originally written in this form at all, it was just a joke from Wohler, but it begins, "Monsieur, I'm eager to communicate to you." It's written in French. It's the only paper in French because it purports to be from a Frenchman. "I'm eager to communicate to you one of the most striking facts of organic chemistry. I have confirmed the substitution theory in an extremely remarkable and completely unexpected manner. Only now can one appreciate the great value of this theory and foresee the immense discoveries that it promises to reveal." So then he goes through in great experimental detail describing all the colors and exactly how he treated everything. They started with manganese acetate, which has this formula. Okay, and then he reacted it with chlorine, and as Dumas might have supposed, he was able to substitute the hydrogens by chlorine. In fact, all the hydrogens by chlorine. Okay, and then he reacted that with light and more chlorine, and he replaced the oxygen on manganese. So instead of manganese oxide, he had manganese chloride. And then he replaced the manganese with chlorine, and then he replaced the carbons and the oxygen by chlorine. So now he had a compound that was still the same type as the original stuff, but it was made entirely of chlorine. He said, "For all I know, the decolorizing action of chlorine, in the decolorizing action of chlorine, hydrogen is replaced by chlorine, and the cloth, which is now being bleached in England, preserves its type according to the substitution laws. I believe, however, that atom for atom substitution of carbon by chlorine is my own discovery. I hope you will take note of this in your journal and be assured of my sincerest regards, etc. Schwindler." And the footnote there is this: "I have just learned that there's already in the London shops a cloth of chlorine thread, which is very much sought after and preferred above all others for nightcaps, underwear, and so on." So this didn't make a big hit down in France. Now, in 1849, Kolbe, who had been a student of Wohler, isolated one of these elements. See, the radical benzoyl was never alone. It was always with something else, and you could trade what it is according to dualism, right? But Kolbe prepared the free methyl radical, right, without anything else. And he did it by electrolyzing acetic acid, and he got hydrogen, CO2, and the methyl radical. Now, unfortunately, later, 10 years or so later, the molecular weight would be determined of this stuff, and it was found that it wasn't CH3, although it analyzed that way. It was actually C2H6. It was actually ethane that he had made. But at the time, it seemed to support the radical theory. And ironically, most reactions, as you'll see, that we study are reactions of HOMOs and LUMOs. But remember, it's also possible to have reactions of SOMOs. Why don't you see those so often? Why do we have more examples of HOMO-LUMO than of SOMO-SOMO reaction? Sinead? Right, because they react so quickly that you never have them. Exactly. Okay, but in fact, all these three reactions, which were key in developing both the radical theory and the type theory, did indeed involve SOMO reactions, we now know, although this wasn't known until the 1930s or 40s. So, 100 years later. So the first one, all these things with benzoyl, for example, the changing oil of bitter almonds into benzoic acid, actually proceeds by way of the benzoyl radical with a SOMO. Or the chlorination of acetic acid is like the chlorination of methane that we talked about last time. A chlorine atom comes along, pulls off a hydrogen, then that attacks Cl2 and gives another chlorine atom, and so on. So again, that involves making this radical, Dumas. So the first one was the source of the radical theory. The second reaction was the source of the type theory. And the third one, this electrolysis done by Kolbe to find what he thought thought was the methyl radical, but turned out to be ethane, involved electrolytically removing one of the electrons from the acetate to give a free radical, and then you draw a single barbed arrow here, a single barbed arrow here, you get CO2, and a single barbed arrow here, which makes that into the methyl a radical. So indeed, all these key reactions did involve free radicals. Okay, so we've looked now at the substitution theory and the type theory and substitution reactions and benzoyl, all the work of these competitors and collaborators, Dumas, Liebig, and Wöhler. And now we'll go to the most important development, which is the idea of valence and of benzene as well. And here the name of Kekulé is what is the person who is renowned and appears on the front of the building. But equally innovative, and perhaps better as you'll see, was Archibald Scott Cooper in Great Britain in developing the idea of valence much more clearly, in my view, than Kekulé did. Now, here's a picture of Cooper. He lived to be 61 years old, but was active as a chemist only for a short time, very short time. He was a student. His father was well-to-do. He ran a mill, a cloth factory on the outskirts of Glasgow in Scotland. So he could go and study in Edinburgh, and you know, students in those days didn't just go to one university and stay there. They'd spend a term here, a term there. In the summer, they'd go someplace else to another university. So he spent a lot of time in Berlin as well. And he studied classics and metaphysics, logic, moral philosophy, went to a lot of concerts and so on. But when he was in Berlin in 1855, he decided to study chemistry. And in 1856, he went to Paris to work with Wurtz, who had been a student of Dumas and of Liebig. And he worked on salicylic acid, in fact, one of the compounds you know well. In 1858, there was two special things happened to him. One, he invented valence, and the other was he got fired because he wrote a paper about this, which we'll talk about, in French, and gave it to Wurtz, his boss, to be submitted for publication by the Academy of Science there. But Wurtz thought it was an intemperate paper and put it in his desk to cool off a little while. While this was going on, Cooper's temperature was rising, and Kekulé published his idea about valence, which wasn't as good, but which took over the whole field. And when Cooper blew up at Dumas, Dumas told him he could go back to Scotland if he wanted to, so he did. But then from 1859 to 1892, he didn't do anything. He first went back to Edinburgh and worked as an assistant in the chemical lab, but he had a mental breakdown. And then while he was recovering, here's Kirkintilloch, this town just east of Glasgow, there's this unassuming building with a pet shop in it. But above the door, there's this interesting monument. It says this plaque marks the birthplace of Archibald Scott Cooper, whose brilliant pioneering contributions to chemical theory have won for him international renown, and whose genius, stifled by an early illness, was denied the opportunity of consummation. So when he was recovering from this mental breakdown, he went fishing with his uncle on Endrick Water up in the hills north of Glasgow, and suffered from sunstroke, and that was the end of his productive life. For the rest of his life, he lived in this house where his mother took care of him for his final 33 years. But anyhow, this one paper was really something. He'd written it in French, but he also wrote an English version and published that, which came out before the French version. So here it is, on a new chemical theory by Archibald Scott Cooper, Esquire. And the very first sentence is really interesting. The end of chemistry is its theory. The end means the goal of chemistry. So the goal of chemistry is to develop a theory. No one else would have said that, I think. You know, the goal of chemistry was to improve health, to improve the living conditions, to make better dyes and whatever, but not the goal is to develop a theory. But remember, he had a philosophical persuasion. So the guide in chemical research is a theory. It is therefore of the greatest importance to ascertain whether the theories at present adopted by chemists are adequate to the explanation of chemical phenomena, or are at least based upon true principles which ought to regulate scientific research. So here's this guy who's only been studying chemistry for a year and a half, who comes in and supposes to tell all the experts whether what they're doing is intellectually valid or not. Among those which have lately been developed, there is one, on account of its apparently numerous merits, which particularly claims investigation, and respecting which we deem it would not be unprofitable were either new proofs of its scientific value furnished, or, on the contrary, should considerations be adduced establishing not only its inadequacy to the explanation, but its ultimate detriment to the progress of science. I allude to the system of types as advocated by Gerhardt. So what he's going to say is that types are just garbage, right? And he's writing this in Paris, right? And hoping that Wurtz is going to submit it for publication for him. So this is what he has to say then about the French type theory. He said, should the principle which is therein adopted be applied to the common events of life, it will be found that it is simply absurd. Suppose that someone were to systematize the formation of letters into words that form the contents of a book, right? Were he to begin by saying that he had discovered a certain word which would serve as a type, and from which by substitution and double decomposition, that is, you replace one letter by another letter, or a group from one word into another word and substitute letters and so on, all the others are to be derived, that he had by this means not only could But he by this means not only could form new words, but new books, and books almost ad infinitum, he would certainly state an empirical truth, right? There's no doubt this would work. You could make as many books as you wanted by making words that way. At the same time, however, his method would, judged by the light of common sense, be an absurdity. But a principle which common sense brands with absurdity is philosophically false and a scientific blunder. So much for his opinion of type theory. Right, but maybe he liked radical theory. Oh, this is, you know, the emperor's new clothes. This new kid on the block comes along and says all the experts don't know what they're talking about. Okay, how about, what did he say about the radical theory? That he had, remember, he'd started studying chemistry in Germany, so maybe he was an advocate of that point of view. He said, I can only remark that it is not merely an unprofitable figure of language, but is injurious to science, inasmuch as it tends to arrest scientific inquiry by adopting the notion that these quasi-elements, what does he mean, these quasi-elements? The radicals, right, which are atoms that hold together, contain some unknown and ultimate power which it is impossible to explain. That is, the question is, what holds the radicals together? Okay? That's the real question. And the German radical theory stifles inquiry at the very point where an explanation is demanded, by putting the seal of elements, of ultimate powers, on bodies which are known to be anything but this. Now, he's absolutely right about this, we can see, right? But he stated it rather undiplomatically, right? Especially since he is a new kid on the block. So it wasn't surprising that he got handled rather severely. Now, what did he want to propose as an alternative to these unprofitable points of view? He wanted to focus on the properties of the elements themselves, not types or radicals, not groups of elements. Science demands a strict adherence to a principle in direct contradiction to this view. That first principle without which research cannot advance a step dare not be ignored, namely that a whole is simply a derivative of its parts. So look at the parts and figure out how things are going to work. Do you think this is the right way to do things? Yeah, Henry?
No, not really. Things interact in complex ways.
Pardon me?
Things interact in complex ways.
Yeah, things interact in complex ways. Now, of course, we've tried to do it this way, right? We look at how many, what atoms are there, how many protons in the nucleus. We have just Coulomb's theory and Schrödinger's kinetic energy, and we can get a whole lot of things out of it, right? But the idea that all knowledge can be reduced in that way is a little bit, maybe, of a stretch. Okay, but anyhow, in this respect. As a consequence of this, it follows that it is absolutely necessary to scientific unity and research to consider these bodies as entirely derivative, that is, radicals or types, and as containing no secret ultimate power whatever, and that the properties which these so-called quasi-elements possess are a direct consequence of the properties of the individual elements of which they are made up. And that's what we try to do when we look at, try to take a group like a carbonyl group and analyze it on the basis of what atomic orbitals are coming together to do it, right? It's the properties of the atoms, the atomic orbitals, ultimately, and their overlap and so on, that determines the properties of the molecules. And he decided in this very first paper on this subject to focus on carbon. So he said, in applying this method, I propose at present to consider the single element carbon. This body is found to have two highly distinguishing characteristics. One, it combines with equal numbers of hydrogen, chlorine, oxygen, sulfur, and so on. Is that right? Does a carbon atom combine with equal numbers of those? How could he say so, Matthew? How can he say so? He must have what?
He must think it does for some reason.
How could he possibly think that? What do you think? How many hydrogens does a carbon interact? Four? How many oxygens?
Two.
Two, sometimes one, but two as well, right? So how can it be? How can he say that they're equal numbers? Yeah.
Did he have the wrong mass for oxygen?
Right, he had the wrong atomic weights for some of them, right? So he thought they were equal numbers. Okay. But anyhow, for all that error, what is he talking about? What property do we associate with carbon? Henry? It's valence. So this is the proposal of the tetravalence of carbon. The first idea, right, of that. And the second distinguishing characteristic is it enters into chemical union with itself, so you can have a carbon-carbon bond. Why did that seem surprising to people then? To whom would it seem surprising that you can have a carbon-carbon bond? Richard, who would be surprised that you could have a carbon-carbon bond in those days? Pardon me?
Radical theory?
Why?
Radical?
No, that's not the reason. It is the advocates of the radical theory, somebody like Berzelius. But why? Kevin? Yeah, to hold together things would have to be opposite charges. You couldn't have carbon hold to carbon. But he says, yes, you can. Okay, these two properties, in my opinion, explain all that is characteristic of organic chemistry. So 1858, the date of this paper, is the tetravalence and self-linking of carbon. The idea that carbon is four bonds and that you can form carbon-carbon bonds. And this is absolutely central to understanding organic chemistry. So this is part of his paper, and you can see that he has C2H4. Where did he get the idea of writing formulas in this way, do you think? From whom? This is the very close to the type theory way of writing things, right? So you have C2H4, methane, C2O4, CO2 we would call it, and carbon tetrachloride, right? Although these are the atomic weights he was using, obviously. So he had to double carbon, right, because C is 12, and he had to double oxygens because oxygen is 16. So he says here the four of hydrogen are not bound by a mutual affinity. That is, the hydrogens aren't holding on to one another. How do you know? Because each hydrogen can be substituted by chlorine in a regular series. So you can put 1, 2, 3, or 4 chlorines on in place of hydrogen and methane. If it was the hydrogens holding to one another that made this thing, then the thing would fall apart if you started breaking the hydrogens away, is the idea. The atoms of oxygen, on the contrary, are united in pairs, which will be more fully developed hereafter. So you can't substitute a single oxygen. These two oxygens must be held together. Why would we say so?
Because
Christine? Because they're actually one atom, right? But the hydrogens you can take off one at a time. In the same manner, bodies that contain multiples of C2, right? You can't take one C out of it either. So the C's must be holding together. Okay, take the inverse of this. If the four atoms of hydrogen were bonded together, we could evidently expect to form such bodies as H4Cl4, but you can't get that and so on, these others here. These bodies are not only unknown, but the whole history of hydrogen might be investigated and not a single instance be found in favor of the opinion that it has any affinity for itself when in union with another element. So that all those substitutions of chlorine, like Schwindler, right, would not work according to him, right? So then he, in this same paper, wrote structural formulae. So let's look at some of his formulas. He says, thus, methylic alcohol has this formula and ethylic alcohol has the other formula. Can you see how that one at the top is CH3OH? How that's a structural formula? Right, so here's C, what we would call C. It's attached to H3 and also to O2, which we would call O, which has an H on it. Right? Or this one of ethyl alcohol. What's the bottom group? CH3 attached to CH2OH. Right? So he has these formulas are correct of keeping track of where the valence is. Now this keeping track of valence is called constitution. Remember the previous formulas are composition, what elements and in what ratios. Now we have constitution, what elements are bonded to one another and what type of bond. You haven't seen that yet, but we could have single, double, or triple bonds. Those would be different types. So that's constitution when you write a formula like this. Yeah.
Why are they considered one atom for the
OO? Because if the atomic weight is 8, you have two of them there. Okay. Now, there's a printer's error in this formula. See if you can find it. This was new stuff, so printers couldn't be expected to do good proofreading. Dennis? Pardon me? So what is this compound? What's this group here, Dennis? CH3 attached to? What's this? CH2 attached to? O. So what's this? CH3CH2O. Ethyl O. And then what's on the other side? Nathan? Keep going beyond the oxygen. What's the next group?
CH2.
CH2, and finally?
Another CH2.
So what's the compound, you know? What compound is it? Don?
Diethyl ether.
It's diethyl ether. What's the printer's error? Right, there's no bond shown there. Okay, but this is an appropriate formula for diethyl ether, right? Nobody had any idea about things like this before, right? Benzoyl was just C7H5O, right? Nothing about structure. Here he's showing exactly what's linked to each other. Okay, so that's ethyl ether. Then, this is neat. After that, he said, there is no reaction found where it is known that C2 is divided into two parts. It is only consequent, therefore, to write, as Gerhardt does, C2 simply as C. So from here on, he's not going to write C2, he's going to write C and use the atomic weight 12. Okay, being understood that the equivalent of carbon is 12. Okay, so now he has got single C's, right? If he had not gone nuts and been an invalid the rest of his life, what do you think he might have done next? Do the O's, right? Because it's exactly the same principle. Okay, now here's glycerin. Now, here's the formula, right? CH2OH, CH2OH, then CH2, then CHOHOH. Okay? Now, and the one on the right, glyceric acid, is... C double bond O, we would say now. right? He hasn't quite got there. This is the very first paper about bonding all together, right? So C double bond O, OH, the carboxylic acid group, CH2, and then this same group on the top. And he's almost right about this. The only thing that's wrong is that one of these H's should be here and one of these OH's should be here. So he guessed just a little bit wrong. It should be that way, but he was close. The most amazing thing to me is the next one. This is the formula he wrote for glucose. Now he's got this, he's not drawing dot, dot, dot here, dot, 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 dot. He's using this bracket to show that they're all associated with one another in that way. But what he's drawn is that formula, right? Which is actually correct for glucose, or more properly, the hydrate of glucose, which you get if you have glucose in water. It depends on how well you dehydrate it before you analyze it, right? So this is the hydrate. Where, in fact, glucose is normally considered to be this aldehyde, but it's added water to it. And in fact, you could figure that out. Try to write a mechanism to have water add to the aldehyde to give the dialcohol down there at the bottom. Yeah, Derek? I think Berzelius actually was right, but he was using somebody else's table that didn't have the right. Well, this finally got cleared up just a few years later in 1860 on the basis of using what Gay-Lussac and Avogadro had advocated almost 50 years earlier. Right, that if you use gas volumes and assume they have equal numbers of particles in them, then you can get the correct thing. And in fact, Dumas worked on that as well. Okay? But in the French version, remember, which didn't get published so quickly, he actually used this in the same place that he used that other one in the English version. And here he does draw lines instead of dot, dot, dot. So it's even closer to what we write now. Although there's a typo where this bottom one was supposed to be CHOH twice. He's got CH2OH. But otherwise, it's the same thing. And obviously, he knew it because he had it correct in the English version of the paper. Right, so here's the Old Isle Cemetery in Kirkintilloch, just almost a year ago, a year and 2 days ago, two days less a year ago, and here's his tomb, right, Archibald Scott Cooper, and down here is a thank you note from the students last year in chemistry, right. Okay, because he's the guy that gave us the tetravalence of carbon and the idea of bonds, and without those we wouldn't be having this class. Okay, and Susan Frew helped us put that there. We took up a collection, a quarter apiece, and bought flowers to put on his grave last year. Okay, but Kekulé is the guy that got all the credit because Cooper wasn't around to defend himself. And Hoffman also enters into the story that we're about to tell, and Cannizzaro. Okay, so this is a drawing by Kekulé when he was 13 years old. I certainly can't draw anything like that. Here he drew this when he was 18. So he went to university to study architecture, but he also went to Liebig's lecture. He went to Gießen to study it, but while he was in Gießen, he went to Liebig's lecture and became a pupil of Liebig. And when he finally had finished his work with Liebig, he decided to go to Paris to further his work. What do you think Liebig would say about that? How are Liebig's? Liebig had studied with Gay-Lussac in Paris, right? But what would he think of going to Paris now? Gay-Lussac isn't around anymore. Who would he work for? Dumas, maybe, right? Or Dumas' students, at least in one of Dumas' institutes. So this was the advice he gave him. There you will broaden your horizons. Gießen is a very small provincial town. There you will learn a new language. There you will learn to know the life of a great city. But there you will not learn chemistry. But he went anyhow. So Kekulé traveled around and became acquainted with all the schools of chemistry and so on. He was in Heidelberg in 1856-58 doing research, as I mentioned earlier, under Bunsen on dimethyl arsenic in his kitchen. And he proposed in 1857 a new type. Remember, there was water, hydrochloric acid, ammonia, so on, these types, four types, right? But he proposed a new one based on marsh gas. Methane bubbles up out of marshes. You can collect it that way. And so he wrote it that way. So this, in a sense, was the tetravalence of carbon, to say that there was a carbon that had four things that could be replaced on it. But he was not at all as iconoclastic as Cooper, who said we have a whole new way of doing, these old ways are wrong, right? So he was more in tune with the times. And he, in 1858 then, proposed the self-linking of carbon. So at the same time that Cooper did. And he did everything he could to gain priority over Cooper. He said in this paper, Observations on Mr. Cooper's New Chemical Theory, "In fact, in two memoirs which have appeared in Liebig's and Allen, I have put forward different views which, in my opinion, should furnish a clearer insight into the constitution of chemical compounds. If I may be allowed to indicate that my first paper lays down the principle which I have called the basicity of atoms." He used the word basicity where we would say valence. "If Mr. Cooper thinks he has discovered the cause of having a certain valence," right, "in the existence of a special kind of affinity, something other than plus minus, I am the first to admit that I have no right to contest his priority in this." So here's Kekulé then in Ghent in 1865 when he was the head of a lab, and we'll talk about several of these people in his lab who became important chemists afterwards. And here he is then, he went to Bonn in 1872. So while Cooper was off in Glasgow or in Kirkintilloch being cared for by his mother, Kekulé was aggrandizing all the credit for this. And we'll start. We have two more minutes here, so we'll talk just a bit about the words, about nomenclature, how it relates to this, and the notation that we're going to have for this new idea, and the models that are used. We'll go into this more next time, but let me just start with the nomenclature. Hoffmann, this guy who was there was a picture of him in a top hat in Liebig's lab in Gießen earlier on. He had a real gift for language. He taught in London for a number of years at the Prince Albert Victoria's concert was German, and tried to import modern chemistry into England by bringing in leading people, and he brought Hoffmann to the Royal College of Chemistry. So Hoffmann had an idea for a systematic nomenclature of hydrocarbon radicals. So you see what the idea is here? Anything that has C4 in it you call quart. So you start with quartane, right? Then quartile has lost one hydrogen. Then quartine has lost two hydrogens. Remember, we already had things like methane and methylene differed by two hydrogens, right? But he carries it on, so you can have quartenyl, which has lost another hydrogen, or quartine, or quartinyl, or quartone, or quartonal, or quartune, or quartunal. What do we use for the root for C4 now? Bute, not quart, right? He wanted to make it more systematic, okay, not to come from butter, but to come from the number, right? How did he get these ane, the suffixes to talk about how many hydrogens there? Do you see the system? Aviva? The vowels, A, E, I, O, U. Right? So it didn't all catch on, but some of it caught on. Ane, ene, and ine, which we now spell with a Y, all come from this sequence of vowels. Isn't that neat? And then we'll go on to this next time.